in. It's time now for History Matters, taking a look back at this week in history with the one and only Scott Washington, historian extraordinaire, who joins us here in the studio with a book of history to take us back. How are you?
Oh, my goodness. I'm doing great, Aaron. How about you?
I'm okay.
You know, this is a great week. I mean, every week is... We're just in the middle of it. We thought this would be a nice, pleasant little... And suddenly we're just... Events have caught up with us. But any week when we can feature animals being heroes is always a good week.
I was assuming we were going to to get on this one. Yeah, this is one of your. We've got to start with it because this is one. I know this is one of your favorite stories.
This is
the World War II pigeon. Yeah,
well,
first of all,
there's two of them. Yes, okay, that one. We'll start with that because that's the older one. Then there's another one. But yes, you know, a lot of kids grew up, you know, boys playing with G.I. Joe. But actually, G.I. Joe, the name, is about a pigeon in 1943 that actually saved lives. And it's wild. The British had captured a village in Italy, and they couldn't get a message out to the Americans to stop the bombing because their troops were there. And so they turned to a carrier pigeon that they named G.I. Joe and let it go, you know, with fingers crossed. And this little pigeon traveled 20 miles in 20 minutes just in time to halt the bombings. Like, hey, look, the carrier pigeon has arrived. And
it's good that he went to exactly the right place.
He was. I don't know how
carrier pigeons work,
exactly.
Actually.
Exactly. I mean, in fact, this is the thing that's kind of amazing. His flight, that little pigeon was credited with saving over 1,000 lives. Mm. Isn't that cool? All right, the other one. So any week that features a pigeon, you know, if you feel like, oh, I don't know, I can do anything, think of little G.I. Joe, the carrier pigeon, and you too can make a difference. All right, here's the other one. I love this. You know, when they're first sending animals into space, there's dogs and chimpanzees. Mm. Leave it to the French to come up with something different. 1963, the first cat in space. Felicette.
I'm sure she was thrilled about
gosh,
it, too.
Yes. Well, this wasn't like a cat.
Ooh,
that's
tuna,
like,
and then all of a sudden just...
This was a cat that was not bred over generations, the space cat, no. This was a stray little black and white female found on the streets of Paris, and she was selected to be trained for this mission. So she went up and she came back, and she was the cat's meow. So
all right.
I just happened
guarantee
to
guarantee you stories. She was not like in any second of that trip to space.
Is that right? I was going to say, you know, anyone who's a cat lover is just looking at their cats going, yeah, all right.
Not
finally
sending you into space. have more crunches.
Okay, well, that was on October 18th, and I'm going to, there's two other people that are actual people that...
Both of those were on October 18th.
Yes,
yeah,
both of those on October
that.
18th.
Yep.
One was 1943, the other 1963, 20 years apart. Here are some birthdays. 1848, a fellow named William Arthur Cummings, but he went by the nickname Candy.
Mm-hmm.
Candy Cummings, and he is in the American Baseball Hall of Fame for credited with inventing the curveball. So all you baseball fanatics out there, we would go, really? Somebody actually invented this? And
the true baseball fanatic would be, as soon as you said William Cummings, they'd be like, oh, yes, Candy Cummings. I know him. The curveball.
Exactly. Yeah.
7 years in the major leagues, you know? And got into the Hall of Fame for it.
I don't know how he got his nickname, but I'm guessing there's a sweet story to that, too. Another one is Robert Livingston Stevens. Now, he was born in 1787 on October 18th. He's the guy who figures out when they're having trains were starting to be a force in the nation's travel infrastructure. And so he said, hey, let's take logs, let's turn them crosswise, drive stakes into them for the tracks to go on. So anytime you see and cross a railroad track and you look down those trestles, you go, oh,
he's
now,
the one who figured it out.
Yes, that's right. So
I like that.
Those are kind of interesting ones, I think. At least
you think about like the great engineering marvels,
yes,
and then it's really just these tiny little innovations that make
that's
the
right
biggest difference. Yeah.
Well, and you know that I'm so glad you said that because October 14th, 1946, is when 25 nations got together to establish world standards. And that is so important. It's something we don't think about, mm-hmm. but it really becomes important when you think about electricity and measurements and a whole host of things that we go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because, I mean, the standards of, like, what is an inch? What is a meter?
Right.
What is a pound? Like, these all differed from place to place.
Oh, yeah, and, I mean, if you go from town to town, you know, oh, yeah, well, if I you know, plug in something, the current is going to be the same, at least here in America.
Yep,
in Europe, it'll be different.
One of the most fun stories I heard about that recently was that it was not really until, I think, the 19th century that there were uniform standards of what time it is in the United States. Like, you can go from one town in Maryland to another town in Virginia, and the clock would be slightly different, and it didn't matter because there's no fast travel back and forth. But once trains became a thing, you actually had to know what time the train is leaving in Maryland, what time it's arriving in Virginia. So it had to be the same time in both of those places
in order
for that to work. And now all of a sudden we need uniform measurements.
Well, you know, this along those lines, this is another thing that happens this week about measurements. 1582, Pope Gregory the, let's see, I think he's the 11th or
13th.
12th? 13th, okay.
According to this,
yes. He begins the Gregorian, starts the Gregorian calendar. Now, that's the one we use today. It accommodates the differences of the day and the year and leap year, and it's more accurate. But it on 1582, the prior day was October 4th, and the next day was October 15th. So they made up. That's how out of whack the calendar was, 11 days. But do you know, it wasn't universally accepted. So, what a surprise.
Nothing ever is.
No,
like,
that's right. And, you know, the Protestant Reformation had happened with Martin Luther in 1517. So, you know, there was a great deal of resistance. And
we can't even get people to wear a mask that covers their nose in the middle of a pandemic right now.
That's
like, forget dropping 11 days from the calendar. Imagine if you're, like, my birthday is October 12th. I'm not skipping my birthday this year.
That's right.
Let the November birthdays have
a
year.
Born in 1582. That's all I can say. Otherwise, it would be something. But, you know, it takes until 1752 for Great Britain and the American colonies to adopt this calendar. Now, that's stubbornness. Now, you can imagine how out of whack things were. Well, which day?
Mm-hmm.
Even now, historians are trying to sometimes figure out, did this happen under this calendar or which calendar?
Right, right.
And that's true with, like, William Hooper, who is, most of him is buried over in Hillsboro in the Old Town Cemetery. And that's one of those things is figuring out when he was born, under what calendar, and you will see updates on that.
Yeah. And some of those are just kind of historically interesting, and others are, like, I know just from reading just the history of, like, the Constitution, we've talked about this, like, the constitutional ratification debate, people are having all these arguments across states, and they're responding to each other, so it actually matters in terms of understanding this particular piece that this thing had been written the day before, so you need to know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I'm so glad you said that, because, you know, here in Hillsboro, in the museum, when it was opened, it has a collection of weights and measures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we think of civilization and battles, and certainly those are formative, but it is something about standards. And so these weights and measures, which up until the 1960s, they were actually brought out with someone in full costume to say, yes, these are the official weights and measure, so that someone would know, you know, what's this glass of beer? Is it the measurement? What's a bushel of wheat?
Right.
Is this a standard? And that's how Great Britain made sure that there were standards on both sides of the Atlantic. So everybody knew, what are we talking about?
Yep.
And I think probably the best example of when that didn't happen is the Hubble spacecraft goes up. The telescope is turned on for the first time, $1 billion, and it's out of focus. They trace it back to an English group, an American group, and one used metric standards, the other didn't, on one small measurement, and that throws it off. So they had to send up a repair crew to actually repair it. So it's one of those really interesting, I mean, we're still in that right now about standards. When Facebook finally said, all right, the Holocaust really happened. We're not going to have denial about it. I mean, that's establishing
that's
a
also a standard, yeah.
Yeah. What is the facts?
I can imagine, I would love to be in the room when they turned on the Hubble telescope for the first time, because you know everyone was in there with just like bottles of champagne just waiting to pop, and then they turn it on and everyone looks at it and someone just like very slowly puts the champagne back down on the table and everyone backs out of the room.
And all the heads turn at the same time and people squint. Well, maybe my glasses. Is there something here? And, yeah, so standards are an important thing that I think matter even today when we're talking about events like global warming or anything else. We need to have some agreed upon standard of measurement.
Well, it's how we can have a History Matters segment. Like, what happened this week in history? We need to know what October 13th is. What is October 17th?
Well, you know, you have a birthday.
What is 1924?
So we're going to keep celebrating your birthday all week long, and everyone's going to say that, but on your birthday, you'll be glad to know that John Kennedy actually gave a speech in 1961 at UNC in Kenan Stadium. And I think that's kind of impressive. And he said at that point, I ask you to give to the service of our country the critical faculties which society has developed in you here. I ask you to decide whether you will be, as Goethe put it, an anvil or a hammer. I mean, those are good words.
Yeah.
So you were born on a good day.
I was born on a good day. University day.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly
right. Hence the Kennedy speech. Yeah.
That's it. Also, this is a Carolina connection. On that day, October 12th, in 1858, Thalen Hall down in Wilmington was open for the first time. And what's notable is about a year later, and it's had many performances, it's still in existence today, is that in 1859, a fellow named Edward Everett, a former president of Harvard University, was really intrigued by the character of George Washington, and he began to give a series of orations and speeches, including at Thalen Hall in April of 1859. And it helped raise money to help purchase and save Mount Vernon. So, you know, and who you say, all right, Edward Everett, who's he? He was the other speaker at Gettysburg.
At Gettysburg, right?
That's right.
Yeah. He was the featured speaker, the great orator who
That's
everyone
right.
turned out to hear. Yeah.
And he went on for 2 hours, and then, of course, Mr. Lincoln got up for 2 minutes. And to his credit, Edward Everett did say afterwards in a note to him, Mr. President, you said more in your 2 minutes than I said in my 2 hours.
Yeah. I bet he was just being polite, though. I bet he went home and was like, I gave the best speech.
He did.
And I wrote a nice note to the president. I'm sure he enjoyed that, too. But my speech was crackers.
Well, and that's right. Exactly. In fact, he was asked, would you come in October to dedicate? And he said, no, I need more time, which is a good thing because Lincoln was overseeing a battle on the day that they had proposed.
Right.
The following month, we might not have heard that if he had been there.
Okay.
So one of those good things. Okay.
Yeah. Speaking with with Scott Washington, probably two more, I think.
All right. Well, this is another Lincoln story. 1860, October 15th. So that would be today. There is a young girl. This is actually true. I thought this is urban legend, but it is really true, named Grace Bedell. Mm-hmm. She's 11 years old. She writes a letter on this date, October 15th, 1860, and she writes to the future president, Abraham Lincoln, suggesting he grow whiskers, that it would be better for him. And he kind of laughs about it, and then he does it. And if you see the two portraits, you realize, oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't actually, because I've seen pictures of Lincoln with and without a beard. I'm not sure which I prefer. Like, I think I might be partial to like younger beardless Lincoln versus the beard, because he grew a beard but not a mustache.
That's
he really made the conscious choice. It was like, no, I'm growing a beard.
That's
this is the thing that I'm gonna do.
That was his. He didn't wear a mask, but he wore a beard.
He wore a beard.
Yeah.
It is also interesting. Like, we know that she wrote him the letter. Like, it's not an urban legend, and we know that because I think, unlike today, for the most part, people save letters.
Yes.
You can go back and look at just private correspondence that people had with other in the 19th century. And now, like, we email each other or we text each other, and those are just fleeting and gone.
So you never know the power of a letter and a suggestion. Mm-hmm. And that's still a powerful thing. Okay, do we have time for one more?
Yes, we do.
All right, good. This is another one I love. You know what I love this. 1928.
28, yep.
Yes. Okay. This fella has a great name. And we've always talked about these wonderful names. Marvin Pipkin. And he was hired by GE as an engineer. And as a practical joke, they would always task the new employees to do something that they knew was impossible, which was to develop a light bulb that was frosted from the inside. And they knew this is, you know, people spend so much time and they would think this is great, except that he did it. He didn't know it was impossible. And I like the story because in the times we're in where we hear things, oh, it's impossible. It's like, wait a minute. There are always so many people with creative ideas who are figuring out ways to make it better and to make it things a little better for all of us. And it's not impossible, and it's going to happen, and it's right around the corner, and it might be you who are listening right now.
There you go. And that is how history matters. As always, Scott Washington, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.